Today's talk is given by Dr. Alistair Ray, and his talk is entitled Mega Regions, subtitle the United States of America, or just a bunch of mega regions, an alternative view of the economic geography of the United States. Alistair Ray is a reader in urban studies and planning at the University of Sheffield in the UK. His work focuses on the manipulation, analysis, and visualization of large geographic data sets in relation to cities, neighborhoods, transport, and economic development. More widely, he is a proponent of open access, open data, and open source software. There are some fans of that here today. And he seeks to make use of the wide range of new data sets that have become available in recent years. This is always with the aim of answering important underlying questions. And also very interestingly and admirably, his data analysis and mapping work has also appeared in a variety of media outlets as well as the usual academic channels. And these include The Economist, the BBC, Daily Mail, City Lab, the Washington Post, Wired, The Guardian, and National Geographic, probably amongst others. He tweets at under the radar, and blogs at statsmapspics.com. And he's currently editor-in-chief at an open access journal called Regional Studies, Regional Science. So with a similarly sort of interesting and diverse variety of backgrounds usually within our audience, we should thus look forward to a truly engaging and interesting seminar. So over to Alistair.
Hi, thank you. When should I start?
Whenever you like. But
when do people want to go home?
Yeah, the bit I usually say, 45, 50
okay,
minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
Fine questions.
Thanks very much. The bit when you said, always with the aim of answering interesting questions, that was kind of a lie after in my blur. Sometimes it's just about having a bit of fun and sort of less about interesting questions. This is a bit of both. And this is it's Friday afternoon, so I thought I'd try and tell a bit of a story and talk about research. This is not what I should have been doing last year. I should have been doing some other stuff. So I did this as well. I got sidetracked, and I think that's how research turns out. It's about mega regions. In the United States, so I'll talk more about that. So basically, that's just a little background. I'll talk about myself, and just so you know, I am from what I consider to be the best mega region of them all, the Highlands. But I'm not going to talk about that today. But the United States, that's my blog, my slightly defunct, hardly updated, goddymapit.com Scottish map blog, which I don't do much more. I'm doing all that, a little bit of mapping of election results. At the moment, I'm doing some stuff with the Google Trends team on election data for the forthcoming election. And if you want to look at these slides now or later, that's the URL of this. So, background, I did an undergraduate geography degree at the University of Strathclyde, did a master's degree in geography, urban and regional systems at the Ohio State University. I did a PhD in urban planning, more or less regional planning, at the University of Liverpool. Worked at Manchester, and then about 9 years ago moved to the University of Sheffield. So I'm working my way across the north of England. And always love coming back up north, which to me, like I said before, is actually down south. Anyway, that's me, that's kind of some of the stuff that I do recently. And the next 40 minutes or so, I'll give you a background to the study. Although I say that sometimes it can be a bit fun, there's actually a more important intellectual theoretical background, which I won't talk about too much. But I want to say a little bit about the history of that, because I don't really think the origins of what we're doing are new, but some of the results are new and I think interesting. I'm going to say a bit about open access publishing. I know people go on about it a lot, but it's quite important in this in terms of who it reached, so I'll say how it made a difference. I did want to talk briefly about the power of maps. I'll only mention Donald Trump very briefly during that bit. And mainly it's about the US Mega Regions project. And slightly bizarrely, but relevant nonetheless, I'm going to talk about the Tampa Bay Rays baseball stadium, which is called Tropicana Field, and show you a picture of a bobblehead, which will make more sense once I get to that part. So the background to all this, many of you in the room will be familiar with this, but I thought I'd just go over it to show you the lineage behind it. So, this very thick book called Megalopolis was written by Jean Gottman, a French geographer working in the United States. And that was my copy, and I just took a picture to prove it does have 777 pages. And in the foreword to the book, he says he thinks it provides only a brief introduction to the topic. But this is a book basically where Gottman talks about this emerging, highly urbanised area in the eastern seaboard of the United States, which he obviously famously called Megalopolis, and all those continuous urban area, which, give or take a few missing bits from Boston all the way down to, I suppose, Virginia and south of Washington, D.C. And it's interesting, given today's things and how everything comes along again and again, and we all think it's new, how some of the topics we're talking about, manufacturing, commercial organisation, transportation and traffic, some of the stuff that we talked about in relation to mega regions today as if it's new, but actually not a lot of it is. And when you look at some of the visualisations and mapping that you produce, they're really, really nice actually. I think these days sometimes we're in a way constrained by the technology we use because we only think we can do what it will do for us rather than being more imaginative. And that, the last chapter of the book is called Novo Ordo Cyclorum, which is the new order of the ages, which is actually on the seal of the United States. So that's one of the pieces of background. Another one, which I tweeted yesterday, is this kind of stuff. The idea of European regions, this is the other European equivalent. If you're not interested in spatial planning, but who isn't, obviously, but let's say for some reason you weren't interested in European spatial planning, you may not be familiar with this concept of the blue banana. To give you the background, there was a study in 1989 by the French Statistics Agency, and identified this big area, kind of from the south Midlands of England all the way from Italy, going through sort of Rhine-Ruhr area, taking in a little chunk of Paris, and they presented a report, a French government minister, so a journalist said, hey, what's that banana? And it became a thing that was written up in the Renouvelle magazine, and it turned into this thing called the blue banana. But it was a bizarre but actually interesting concept that had some kind of purchase. So that was a European spatial planning metaphor, but it's really about the organisation of areas. More recently, people like John Harrison and others at Loughborough have written about megaregions. That book, the bottom right, was published in 2015 or 16 maybe, and there was a piece of work by the Regional Plan Association in the States called America 2050 trying to map out where some of these functional mega regions were, and it was very nice looking. We had, you know, Southern California, Northern California, Cascadia, and a variety of other ones across the country, but that was more conceptual. It wasn't necessarily driven by data. So it's another piece of background. Then a bit more practically, you know, what's all this for? So this is an example of the practical use of housing and policy. That's the Federal Highway Administration webpage on mega regions, and they use these kind of areas for planning a variety of things, so it could be freight, economic vitality, and so on. And a little bit of a side here is that we're taking this approach, and we're actually seeing how it looks if you do it in this country. I'll talk about that later in Scotland and also in Wales. So partly it's related to when people reorganise local government, how do they do it, but that's another topic. This is about the mega regions. That's how it's used by the Federal Highway Administration. And this is their definition. Their mega regions are characterised as a network of urban clusters and their surrounding areas. And it talks about infrastructure relationships. So a lot of this is very infrastructure driven, so people are trying to think about how mega regions might be useful for planning stuff like high-speed rail, which I've heard isn't a top priority of the new government in the United States. Nonetheless, it's an idea that has been quite widely used in terms of transportation planning. So there's a few interesting papers on that from the FHA. So that's a bit more background. More widely, this whole idea about things being connected is something that people have really got onto. Has anyone read Connectography? No. You probably see it go through an airport. And I was written by Parag Khanna. This was out of one of the reviews of the book. Now, that was, I think, a review from the New York Times. And the reviewer said that there is an interesting essay nestled inside the enormous pile of fluff that is Connectography. That was a very kind of view. Evgeny Morozov, wrote a review of a previous piece by Parakana, which is the most savage book review I've ever read. That's what I mean. Nonetheless, it's one of these things actually that people can see how this makes sense, but they're not quite sure how you should understand it. This is based on ideas, not empirical work. So this was driving our thinking about, you know, the United States, mega-regions, functional economic geography. People are talking about functional areas, economic geography, but how do these places actually connect together? You can look at connections like that, it's a nice looking map, but what does it actually look like on the ground? So that was partly our question. Instead of doing that on a conceptual level, and not that I would necessarily call it a pile of fluff, it's not very empirically grounded. So our question, we did have a kind of question, everyone talks about the economic geography of places and also about mega-regions. How can we systematically define them, and actually can we? So that was a starting point. Another side to that was, how can we avoid doing all the work we're supposed to be doing for the next few months? And can we actually do this, and is my computer big enough? They were supplementary questions, actually, if I'm honest. But that was our basic question. I'll say a bit about open access, because that leads up to some of the interesting impacts that this paper had. So I wanted to put this up here because it's important about this paper. So the idea, of course, that we do stuff in academia that is like this. Obviously, I'm sure what you do is like that. People are trying to get into that vault and get all the gold nuggets. But actually, just more simply, people will find your work. That did happen in our case. People can read it, and actually it's interesting to see people, well, interesting and worrying when people read your work and come back and ask questions about it, but that's also good to happen with this. We shared the data, which we think is a nice thing to do, and it's a good thing to do, it's the right thing to do, and that also will look bad if we don't share it. People have shared all sorts of stuff back with us and given us new ideas, which have been really good, and it's helpful. But of course, the last thing here is that, you know, when you do it in an open access environment and hundreds of thousands of people view your paper and view your work, that's also worrying, because if we thought people were going to read it, would we write in different ways? Well, possibly. And we did think about that. We didn't expect so many people to actually look at it. But it's good that they did. And most of the reaction was quite positive. But, you know, there's a few people said, "Great idea, say nothing," which is always good. So that was really important. A previous study of mine, less successful, on the geography of submarkets. I was looking at home the other day for another study, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I click on the link at home, I'm not on the VPN, and I can buy 24 hours access to my own paper for £28. So I passed on that. But actually, nowadays, I don't know about it, but Sheffield is a big open access fund and people are having less problems accessing our work, but it's a problem. And this was a piece in the Times Higher about people facing shifting landscape in publishing. It did say new PhD students, but I think actually pretty much everyone. Although I know people who have been in academia for a long time maybe disagree, but I think things are changing, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend publishing everything like this, but it was an important part of what we did. That's just a piece I'm putting for future reference, because we actually share the data, so people could go and check if we got it right. Now that's good in a way, but one of my colleagues did get a handwritten letter from somebody about another paper telling them they've got their matrix algebra wrong, which, and then they were going to write to the editor about it. So, you know, there's always a danger, but I think that's good in publishing and science. Okay, the other question, you know, we had that question about economic geography. The other question about open access, I suppose, is why are we here as in maybe in academia? Some people, maybe it's because we're not sure what we want to do with our lives, hopefully not. Maybe it's number two, we want to change the world in some small way. I probably still think that. But I think the answers to these two questions have some bearing on how we publish. That's part of what I'm talking about here. And that's why, from the beginning of this project, we thought people might be interested in it. Let's open up the data, and let's open up the paper itself. Okay, back to this. So the power of maps, I think we were quite lucky in relation to when the paper came out, because it was just, when was the US election? November 2016? This came out, I remember, 20? Sure. This came out in November the 30th, 2016, this paper, which was just after a time when people had been looking at lots of US maps in different colours and so on, and they were not happy about how the map looked, many of them, and people were interested in different visuals. So it's a reminder again of the power of maps for me practically about how this was received. So, reminder about when you do it wrong. Does anyone remember that story when the front of the Eurostat report in 2004, they left Wales off. And if you see, just see it there, Wales is in there. Maybe it was in a part of a shapefile or something that didn't get on. And has anyone looked at the maps without New Zealand blog? There's a whole blog dedicated to maps that don't have New Zealand on them, because people from New Zealand justifiably get annoyed when they're not on it. So that was interesting. So when you get it wrong, people are impressed. But recently, did anyone see the thing where they said the president likes maps? And he wanted briefings preferably in one page with a map, and sometimes just a map. So that's probably the only thing you have in common with Donald Trump, although I also have a Gaelic-speaking mother, and I have that in common with them too. I think the similarity is there. But it was quite interesting, you know, it's a reminder about the power of maps, this project, to me, and how people engage with them and respond to them in ways they wouldn't to text. So I think that's kind of an important background. Now, really, the main story is about US megaregions. That's my heavy laptop, which is extremely heavy, but it's very good. But I've since discovered someone else's department's got a better one, so I'm looking at that. But that was the basic idea. I was partly trying, I was working between a server, a supercomputer, and a really powerful desktop, a laptop, and it's heavy as a desktop. And actually, it's quite interesting. We're at the technical bits here, but we're at the stage where the personal computing power is really quite advanced, so we don't need to use servers, or our supercomputer at Sheffield is called Iceberg. I get the impression people just use it, so they can swan around and say, yeah, I'm just going to use Iceberg today. There's a lot of that kind of big data boasting. We have these massive data sets, but often not enough thinking. So I was just going to see what I can do with this. And the data set I'm talking about today only had about 4 million rows of data. It wasn't that big. So that was a bit of a job. But the first thing I did was, can I just map out commutes? So give you a background to what this is. The lower 48 states here, they are split into about 74,000 individual census tracts. And there's a data set which details commutes between them. So it's a 4 million or so by 4 million matrix origin and destination data set. But obviously, most of those cells are empty because people don't commute from Boston to San Diego. So there's about 74,000 squares, but it's about 4 million cells of actual data. And all I did at first was I just mapped it and plotted it out just to see what it looked like. And on this map, it just shows all those commutes, individual lines of 100 miles or less. Right, so that's all that is. So it showed you what you'd expect. That's the urban pattern of the United States, urban footprint. But it also does show you which direction places connect with, the different kind of connections. You can see here Atlanta. And it's kind of spokes, and then Dallas, and then somewhere maybe more interesting, around a bit in Illinois, Peoria, Illinois, little triangle. So you can see the connectivity as well as the urban footprint. That was just a first stage, it was quite interesting. And it wasn't what we wanted to do. The next stage was just me just experimenting further. So I did some more mapping of that, and I took a NASA base layer looking at the lay of the land. I was just looking at the interesting relationship between topography and human activity, and it's as you'd expect, of course. So that was just me looking at some different parts of the United States.
So that was still experimentation. The next stage was just, I wrote up a little working paper on the method. And part of the reason was, this is a data set that's really hard, first of all, to find it on the internet. You know it exists, but it's buried really deep down on the Federal Highways Administration website, in maybe like an Access database, and then I'd find it, download it, and when I tried to go back to it, stupid me, I just couldn't find it again. So there's that, first of all, there's all these data sets that are really useful, hard to find, then when you get it, it's hard to work with. So I just tried to make sense of it and put it online and make it available for people. So I wrote this, it's on the University of Sheffield repository. I just set out a method, I wouldn't recommend reading it, it's a bit dull, but it tells you how to do it, and I think replication is important. So I put that on there, it tells you the technical specs of my computer, just so you know what hardware to use and so on. And then I did a few pieces on it, just on my old blog, and also on, I think maybe City Metric, but that was in August 2015, so that was the first stage of this. So I'm telling you this because this is how the sort of ideas travelled in this project. I can't remember why,
But I like making animations, little GIFs and animations of data, because sometimes when you're doing stuff like commuting, like this, commuters move, they go one way and then they come back, usually. So I was writing about polycentric urban areas at the time, and I classed a case in transport planning, so a polycentric development is in the Bay Area, the nine counties of the Bay Area around San Francisco. People like Robert Severo and others have written a lot about that. So I was interested to see which way people went in the crisscrossing. And that is that was quite one of the share too. But that was just a bit of fun. After that, this was really interesting. So this is something that I couldn't have done this. I don't have the skills. I could probably get the skills, but it would take me a couple of years. Mark Evans used to be a programmer working for food shop Borders. He was in between jobs. He saw my data and said, oh, that's cool. I'll turn this into an interactive animated map that has the dots style like I did, but it also gives you the data table. And then he did that, and so he did it for the United States. I also said, why didn't you do a thing with the Wales, which he did. But the comments in his blog piece were all from local economic development people, planners, regional policy people, said this is really useful. We know this data exists, but we never really had it in a useful form. So that was really amazing, a brilliant piece of work. And I put the link in if you want to follow up and look at that. Then this is where Garrett Nelson comes into it. Garrett Nelson is a postdoctoral fellow at Dartmouth College in the United States. And he saw my data set. And what he had another idea about it that I hadn't thought of to that point. He said, could he take the data set and then apply a natural communities algorithm to it. So when we look at the map, we plot all those lines, we look at it, and through sort of basic process of visual cognition, we chunk up the data set into what we think is different parts, visually, kind of a visual heuristic. But Garrett thought he could use some network partitioning software, which looks for strengths of connections between areas, and then groups them by what they call natural communities. Anyway, he tried to do that for the whole United States, but the data set was too big. So he's from Massachusetts originally, so he thought he would do that, and he blogged it. He did that because it was his birthday and he took the day off. Right? So he was just having a bit of fun with the data set. Then he blogged it, and I saw that and said, hold on a second, let's try this for the whole United States. So instead of just taking the lines and looking at how they're connected, let's test strength of connections based on the volume of flows between places. Now you'd expect that just to be near places are more connected, but we didn't really know. So that was when we embarked on this, but we weren't quite sure how we would do it. The software is produced by guys who work at the Sensible City Lab at MIT, and the paper and the write-up is by Sobolevsky et al., and that's just an example of a similar kind of thing. I can't remember if it's commute data, but I believe that's Portugal. All these lines mean is that the combo algorithm produces kind of better result. There's lots of ways you can do this, dividing up network data. It's just very efficient, and it works very well, but it's quite tricky. Once you go beyond about 30,000 origin of destinations, it takes a long time, and I worked out if we'd done it on my computer, we'd have taken 64 days, which wasn't really doable. So that's Garrett Dash Nelson. His middle name is Dash, by the way. His parents couldn't have foreseen the change in the internet use. So that's Garrett Nelson. So he's, I would say, it was quite an interesting relationship. We had skills that each of us didn't have and very complimentary. But I've still not met Garrett, but I've invited him over in November, so hopefully I'll actually meet him. It took me months to actually even Skype him. But Garrett did a lot of technical stuff. But it allowed us here to back. It allowed us, it didn't actually matter, this is partly a story about academic work and the day. We did it in Google Docs collaboratively, obviously Garrett was mostly five hours behind. Shared the files in Dropbox. We used cloud computing. Instead of putting in an application for a grant for £25,000 for a supercomputer to be obsolete pretty quickly, we used Amazon Web Services, which cost about $20 a run. So if you get any big number crunching jobs, Amazon Web Services, run a virtual Windows machine in it, but we use Linux about $20 ago. We did it several iterations, about 5 main iterations. We reduced lots of maps. We targeted a big open access journal, which was PLOS One. Lots of Skype chats, submitted in summer 2016 and published at the end of November. Just because we thought it was something. The data set, commuting data sets, they age, they're already quite old. It's the same in this country. Commuting data sets don't come out until a couple of years after. So we're worried about, you know, if it gets stuck in another journal for 18 months or 2 years. We wanted to get out there. We also chose this journal because the kind of publishing platform is very appealing for visuals. As of a couple of days ago, when I consider a paper going viral when it's got 500 views, that's pretty, like, yeah, I'm excited about that. Today this has had about 233,000 views, quite a lot of shares and so on. The data is on Figshare. I think it's up to about 6,000 downloads. Again, which is, I'm expecting a letter of the post telling us how we got it wrong at some point. But the biggest problem in this, like anything, was the messiness of the data set, and the area codes were all wrong, and they all had leading zeros or missing zeros or whatnot. We knew that other people using this data set would have the same problem, so we thought we'll put it all available, we've cleaned it all up, we've done all the legwork, and hopefully people can do stuff that's a lot better than us. But we published lots of shiny maps as well, because we knew when you do that, the first thing people want to do is see their area. So we put that all online, and if you're interested in the individual areas, you can go and click on one of about 50 maps. Okay, where are we up to? Just in case you're into this kind of thing, Altmetric, they track all these papers, and it, I'm told a figure of 20 or above is quite good. That's 850, so it reached a lot of people. The reason we know that is because people
keep emailing us.
So I should probably talk about the actual method, but not too much. So in our paper, if you look at it, we say, you've got this kind of approach, which is essentially a visual heuristic approach where you look at something like that and you sort of chunk up that and think, well, that looks like Southern California, mega region. Well, that looks like the Bay Area one. That's probably Dallas. But when you get into areas like this, it's more difficult to tell. So, for example, if you're in northern New Jersey or southern New Jersey, we'll get to this in a bit, people will go one way or the other. But it's not necessarily based on distance, it may be based on cultural ties or different things. If you're in the northwest of England, for example, I used to live in Liverpool and work in Manchester, and you'd get people who maybe they were in Birchwood or Warrington, which is about halfway between, and said, they'd never consider going to Liverpool, or they'd never consider going to Manchester, even though it's so close. I met people in Liverpool during my PhD, and I'd talk to them about Manchester, expect them to know, and they'd say they'd never been there. And I'd say, why not? And they'd say, why would I want to go to Manchester? So there's a distance thing, but there's also cultural ties, there's also other reasons and other things going on. But you can't quite tell, you can sort of assume things. So we went from something like that to this. So that was in the paper, and that's us using the data and a bit of processing. What we did there was we deliberately had sort of loose, chunky borders, because when you draw borders on maps, that's obviously asking for trouble. So that is supposed to be, what do we call it, interpretive analysis. So we're deliberately saying that's not hard and fast series of boundaries, but it's something that does emerge from the data when you actually draw lines around the communities. So the next step, is to talk about Waldo Tobler. The reason being, this is a statement from the paper. So the algorithm we use does not take into account where any of these individual places are. All it does is look at the strength of connection between them. Now, Waldo Tobler's classic first law of geography talk about near things are more related to distant things. Okay, fine. So census tracts close together should have stronger connections. And generally, obviously, they do, but there's exceptions. This was a couple of years after I was at a conference and we went down to see Waldo at UCSB. So, and actually, I'll probably never go back to the Santa Barbara because it was unbelievably hot. But it's interesting experience talking to Waldo about this sort of old geographical ideas, and actually some of them are still very useful. But the positioning algorithm, it doesn't consider where places are. So we thought, well, this is a kind of test case, apart from anything else, about whether it's just going to be near places. And actually, when you do the plot, I originally did, of just the origins and destinations, you do see some interesting things. You see it in UK or Scottish and some Welsh data as well. You can see these things that are very long distance, high volume moves. You can identify often things like
is it arms plots when a regiment moves and there's a few hundred at the same time. So you see those anomalies, and sometimes those anomalies can be picked up quite easily visually. But this was kind of a test of that. I just thought I'd put that picture in because this is about commuting. And the University of Santa Barbara has skateboard lanes on campus. I haven't noticed any at Infra. But this is commuting, so we don't know how people commute, but it is about commuting, and the vast majority of places on that map is car travel. Maybe a few exceptions like Chicago or Boston or New York, but generally it's people going in cars, not skateboards. Okay, that's a big chunk of text. The reason I put that up is because this statement here, visual heuristics differ from algorithms which are guaranteed to provide a correct solution. So we were like, algorithms, correct solution, is that really true? Of course not. Because people decide how the algorithm works in the first place. I mean, you could say, and that's the same you can say about Google. Google will always give you the correct result based on what Google thinks the correct result is. Right? So that was a piece. I mean, we weren't really sharing anything about that. Smelson Carmel paper in 1987 when they say that, but we were quite struck by that. They said it was guaranteed to provide the correct solution. So with this, what we were really, we were partly testing whether the algorithm gives results that actually make sense to people. And what we found was that mostly yes, but it still requires some human intervention, because when you're setting your parameters for all this, you could force it to have 80 communities or 90 communities. We ended up doing it, it would come out with 49 or 50, but we would restrict it to, I think we restricted to a maximum of 50, actually. So there was some, obviously we weren't just letting it run. So we didn't agree with that idea that algorithms are guaranteed to provide a correct solution. Okay. So that's what we're doing in the paper. You've got this visual heuristic approach and you've got an algorithmic approach. That number is a big number in this context because when a network partitioning algorithm works very well, you get a number very close to one. Right, so that in this whole field about networks and structures, a value of 1 indicates networks with strong community structure. That would be considered very high. So that is the final run we did using this combo program on the entire data set. So all you need to know about that is it tells you this community. And what that really means is the communities we identify, very high proportion of people are within those communities and there's not much overlap. Okay. So how did it look? Well, that's just one example. From the paper, one of the maps, these are those communities. So when you take that map and you apply the algorithm to it, the areas that are the same colour are individual communities, individual, if you like, mega-regions. So you can see there that actually Southern California is a little bit separate from this part of the Central Valley and to the north of the area, and you get smaller ones, places you might expect, but places you might not expect. So Eureka area, Northern California. It was really quite interesting. The first thing people did when we published this was look at the maps and zoom in the areas. And it did actually, it was interesting for us. It was a peak in Google Trends. I mean, it seemed to have an impact. People were probably so despondent about the election results. They would look at anything. So that was one of the maps we did. And I'll show you some more detail in a minute or two. So we did that. Another one, that was one there. I did a black version just for viewing online. Same thing, just a different colour. And you start to see how you get some regions like you'd expect. Like if you look at Minneapolis, the monocentric urban area, and then you look at this, essentially, we called it first the Corn Belt into Illinois and Iowa. Area I was familiar with here, Central Ohio, which is Columbus, Ohio, where I lived for a couple of years, was interesting. But what was coming out as well was the way things sometimes, you can't see it here, but sometimes you can kind of see it here. You would occasionally see these quite clean cutoffs at state lines, which didn't seem to make sense from distance, but actually, occasionally it was to do with different local income tax regimes where people were less likely to go one way than another. I can't remember, it could have been Illinois and Wisconsin. There was a couple of those cases. Another one was the Connecticut, New York state border. It's quite interesting as well. So there was a few things which kind of went against the expectation in terms of distance. So in the Washington Post, we did a kind of different version of that, some other graphics. I'm trying to show you. Yeah, so for a while it was very popular.
work, I suppose. But this was what was most interesting to us. So what we did, we got an invite from Reddit. I'm a bit old-fashioned, actually, in a sense. I don't really use Reddit. I barely understand how it works, actually. Does anyone use it? No. It's just really interesting. So it looks like a very messy web page, but apparently people use it and ask questions on it. So what we did was this thing called, what's it called, Science Wednesday. And Gareth and I went online live and we got loads of questions in advance and loads of discussion. I thought it was going to be a hate fest, but that was because a few days before the Daily Mail published something. And you can't let, they'll just publish anything, they don't ask. And below the line you just get all sorts of abuse. So it was a bit worrying. But Reddit was interesting because people were looking at the maps and they were saying, actually, this does make sense based on where I go. And there really wasn't much bad feedback. There was occasional ideas about, we named the mega regions as well, which is also very risky. Garrett's a historical geographer as well, so he's got more knowledge, but I was okay about some of them, giving them some names. But this was an interesting one. There was lots of this stuff. This guy says DC Baltimore is spot on as well. And Lee Mainland all the time, it really gone beyond the areas of Virginia, West Virginia and Pennsylvania that they included. So people were saying, oh, well done, you got it right. But actually, it was just as, processing the data using the COM algorithm. This guy from, person from Arlington, Virginia, they agree as well. Baltimore feels much more like a part of my home region than Richmond does, even though it was a bit closer. Someone in Roanoke, they agreed, but they had a little bit of discussion. So there was quite a lot of that. That was kind of risky thing to do, I suppose, but it was quite interesting to see how people were agreeing with us. So there, that comment there, driving past Front Royal even feels like driving into another state. So there were those kind of cultural things where people would go places and not go places based on things that weren't just to do with distance. I think,
hopefully not enough time, I just wanted to,
probably enough time, just want to click, I've opened up the tab. So this was the thing we did after the feedback, then we renamed some of the regions. So that's the Central Ohio, Cincinnati, Columbus one. Chillicothe in Central Ohio, I thought that would be a good name for it because it used to be the state capital and you can't call it Columbus or Cincinnati because they'll both go mad. And Chillicothe is kind of the middle. So we did an interactive version, so if you're really interested in this, I'll just quickly go into this. So that is the interactive version. Hopefully it works. Let's zoom to this one here. Click on some city labels. This was quite an interesting one, another area I'm familiar with. I think the original mapping of US states had Toledo in Michigan, but it's actually in Ohio. So I used to go up from Columbus to Detroit sometimes. My grandparents lived there and got married there in the 1930s. Before coming back to Scotland. So I was familiar with that area. So there were a few areas from my own experience I could say, well, that kind of makes sense. What you get is this is pretty much a Chicago metropolitan area. But when we got a bit of feedback about, that becomes the corn tassel rather than the corn belt. This was just a little bit of kind of playfulness about the data to get people interested in it. Garrett thought it was being funny calling the Los Angeles area El Asfalto. Which some people seem to be a bit messed about. So we did that, and that was really just for kind of engagement purposes, getting people to be interested in the data set. But what's underlying this is patterns of economic geography. You can measure functional economic geography a number of ways. We just did one thing that's very important, and that which was commuting. So that was quite good fun, actually. The one thing I wanted to say about that is there was this big area which was empty and unlabeled, and the people from Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming were quite annoyed. There's not that many of them, so it's a bit like, from the Highlands, it's not on the map as much as you want it to be, but actually there was no real single region. So this becomes the kind of, well, it's essentially the Northern Plains region, which is lots of smaller places that don't really register. So that was towards the end. Back on. That was interesting. Final version of that.
how does this all relate? I want to give you one practical example. So loads of people contacted us from economic planning bureaus across the country. One was particularly interesting. I got an email from a guy called Bill Walsh. He said, "Hi, Alistair, how are you doing? It's very interesting." And I thought, okay, who's this? He said he was the vice president of strategy for the Tampa Bay Rays in Tampa Bay, who are currently planning a new stadium. And if you know anything about major leagues in the States, you know that they spend tons of money on new stadiums. It's very controversial. There's always massive rows locally about public money going into them, and they cost about $500 million or above. I think the new Dallas Cowboys stadium cost $1 billion in Arlington. It has got a giant telly in it, also. But they're doing planning, and they had 9 potential sites. So he was just interested. Look, so for major league sports, people will travel a long way. Much further than they were for work. And Tropicana Field, it's typical in the US case, it's only about 20 years old, but already it's not able to compete. So I was interested in that. I was looking at the 9 different sites. So I just set up some data and tried to plot out what I thought would be a helpful series of maps, actually. I didn't really know much about Tampa Bay Rays, but as soon as I heard my last name was Ray, I thought, why not? So I did some mapping for him. He did a master's in urban planning at Columbia University as well, so he had a background in this kind of stuff. Oops, that's me summing up almost. So I did some maps for him, and then he said, "I'm going to send you some swag from the club shop." So he sent me a beer cooler, 3 baseball caps, a headband, 25 stickers, and a bobblehead of somebody called Kevin Kiermaier, who I've never heard of because I'm not into baseball. Anyway. So that's partly a story of unexpected impacts of research when you do open access work. And I know who Kevin Kiermaier is. I used to be a basketball player, so I'd much rather it was a basketball team, but I'll take what I can get. But it was quite interesting. And also, the extent to which people like him were interested, and they also found something useful was quite interesting. Okay, I'll probably sum up. I think I've talked for a long time. So... key points: it's not procrastination if you do something useful. That's my rule. Number 2 is it isn't strictly true, but it gets you off the hook. I think the key thing really here is, more seriously, this conception of migration is not a new idea at all, but we've rarely seen people actually apply some systematic and critical analysis to it. We use an algorithm that had already been used in different data sets. The previous one, I don't know if anyone remembers it, from 2010, some researchers at MIT and King's in London and some guys from British Telecom, they took a data set of telephone calls, it's published in the same journal, and they looked at about 1 billion telephone calls in Great Britain and used the same algorithm and then came up with a number of regions. John Reeds, who's at King's as well, was involved in that, I know him. So that was quite popular, although what that showed actually, one of the things that showed is generally people in Scotland know to call each other according to that data set. Which I was quite miffed about. It should be more, fine-grained than that. But that was just about phone calls and personal interactions. And after publishing this, of course, we feel really stupid because there's a few major papers in the area that were somehow completely missed, but they were written by physicists. One of them was about the circulation of dollar bills. Because I can't remember the data, but there's this website where people track money across the country. I can't remember what it's called. But they track, I think they just do a manually and take down serial numbers and you can get the data set. Somebody did that, I think it might have been a physicist, and it was published in the same journal, and we said sorry for not completing the work. But that was a small data set, quite incomplete. So that approach was, it struck a chord, I think, because it was about economic geography. Number 4 lesson, I suppose, is the power of maps should never be underestimated. Obviously people take what they want to from a map, but people also assume a certain level of truthfulness, which is something interesting. Open access, I think for me that was a key thing here. Some of the stuff I do, I would call it niche, other people would call it boring, so there's not really much of a call for it, which is fine. I think it opens doors, it starts new conversations with interesting people. I think that's a good thing, and it's going to re-energize me in that sense. And the key thing that's really interesting, people on Reddit agreed that the results made sense, they seemed to be right. So the next phase really is there a 7th point? No, it's just that. The next phase is what I'm going to do now. We've done that initial plotting it out. Garrett and I, hopefully in November, are going to do some follow-up work
we got carried away with ourselves and talked about a book, but we're going to try to do a paper and some analysis about the things like GDP and population growth and different connections of mega regions. But I mean, this is just a, I don't really do a lot of this kind of stuff. I'm writing a little bit at the moment about population growth. I realised actually yesterday that I'm doing a population paper on mega cities, so I have to move away from the mega stuff. What I'm really doing at the moment is looking at something entirely different, but it's using data sets like the transport in the UK and looking at Glasgow, Leeds and Manchester and looking at the five communities and where transport access to the local job market is bad. So it's not necessarily related to that, the techniques might be. So this was very much a side project that ended up turning into a mega region project. And I think I've used up all the time and goodwill, so I'll stop. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
What did I get wrong?
Obviously, the ONS produced a travel work area for Britain.
Yeah.
Have you thought about looking at their methodology and using some of our algorithms in the States to see how that compare and contrasts?
Do you mean using the ONS one in the US?
Well, no, using it in the British context, but seeing whether the travel work areas that the ONS have created.
All right. Yeah. Well, one of my colleagues here, Ruth Hamilton, we did England and Wales and Scotland as well, separately, using Combo, and we're comparing it to that. I think the ONS travel to work area got a self-containment figure of about 75%, and our areas look pretty similar. We were doing that actually for the whole of Great Britain, but then we decided actually we'll just look at Scotland, partly because, I don't know if you remember the Reform Scotland report, which was talking about reducing the number of local authorities from 32, they came up with this list, which was slated, which had 18 local authorities. But interestingly, Aberdeen, Glasgow, Edinburgh, and Dundee were unchanged. And maybe the Highland region was unchanged, but some of them. So we were thinking in the context of this kind of stuff, would be quite interesting to see what you get. And we did it for, I don't know how many came out in Scotland, we did maybe 16. But in England, the travel to work area, there's quite a lot of overlap. The only real difference was London, when you do it in a kind of mega region where it was much bigger. And it goes way beyond what people could possibly accept as a one. You know, like it was way beyond the compares of people.
So that,
yeah. But no, that's phase three, I think. Thank
you. Any in terms of how to geocode a large number of data sets?
Well, to be honest, we did all this using Combo for the processor, which is a bit tricky, but everything else was just in QGIS. And a good computer that we were using, they were both a piece of machines, and unless you get into this like, tens of millions, it pretty much handles it. I mean, it was all point data, and drawing those lines, drawing 4 million lines, it's a bit slow, but it works. So, yeah, a good computer and open source software. I was going to try it, and some of us were going to do it in R, but actually it worked fine in Q, so it didn't bother.
Sort of thing
I know. First phase of like, what does it look like when you do this? But yeah, you're right. I think when he did that, it was published by the Washington Post, all the comments were like, suck it up, loser, you guys lost. It was all that, so it was a bit, like, a bit risky.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a question, but I like the idea of the open publishing, because you disseminate your information, but then also blogging it makes it more accessible, so it's really good.
Yeah.
But we as a, we say we're a lot of corporation, we're pretty crap at making our research available. You see Paperscape?
No, what's that?
Paperscape is what the astrophysicists do. So when you publish in a peer-reviewed journal, your what's it called, your first year draft that goes to the publishers.
Yeah.
So your then goes into a repository.
Yeah.
And then that goes to ridiculous, like 1.4 million papers. But the best thing about Paperscape, apart from the fact that you get access, open access to all of these journals from astrophysicists, their visualization is like a galaxy. Amazing.
Well, off the papers.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a really good way to, and it's like the diagrams that you have, where you have you end up with clusters and communities of research papers, which you extract through metadata, which is really boring. But the visualization of the metadata is really quite exciting. That's a ramble rather than a question.
No, I've never thought that. What's the in maths the score? What's the maths score? It tells you how far you're away from Einstein or whatever. What's that called? Everyone's got a number. What's a number? I don't remember that. Maybe not.
It's too far away.
It's the same kind of thing. I was thinking, if you had that data, then you could map it out.
You mean the Kevin Bacon number?
It's like that. It's basically a Kevin Bacon number for maths. And that's something that mathematicians can cite. Yeah. I've not seen that, I haven't discussed about the whole open access thing, and somebody who's in a PhD with me is looking into that and sort of regional studies and regional science and forcing us to think about what we do. I mean, some of the stuff I've published has been about spatial statistics and neighbourhoods, and I mean, it's not the kind of thing anyone really be interested in, but it's maybe quite important methodologically if someone's looking. You know, it's the kind of thing that people from government department have invited me down to talk about because they've got to figure out a method. But so I think it's a place in all sorts of stuff. And some of the work in some subjects, I don't know if anyone's seen on Twitter, it's really mean, but it's new real peer review. It's all just needy scientists moaning about humanities research. And some of it does seem like way out the fringes and like what they're writing about that for, but it's but I think generally all knowledge is interesting and good, and if we can't figure out what it's useful for, then it doesn't really matter necessarily. But it would be good to have something like that. Yeah.
So, for any more? We won't be heading in a galaxy-like spiral towards drinks time.
Yeah, all that's got all the links to all the content and data sets. That Mark Evans interactive thing is much better than what we did, I think. So, have fun with that. It's for England and Wales too.
Yeah. Lots to look at. Well, just before we say thank you and scurry over to do your drinks, I'd just like to thank you all for coming and coming over the month. So do sign up to the mailing list if you're not on it, and look out for emails forthcoming in sort of August, September time when I get my schedule and speakers lined up. I've got various ideas burning away. And if you have any particular suggestions as well, you can help shape the direction of the future. So thank you all indeed, and so we'd just like to say thank you very much indeed to Alistair for a fitting finale. Thank you.
Thanks.